not saying that we think of land entirely in terms of money, which is what the Europeans would convict us of. It's not true, but it isn't something which has a sacred quality that it would have had before. So America, as it moves west, is involved in this people owning thousands and thousands of acres of land that they've never seen, but they're holding on to in order to speculate. People that are going in and squatting all over the place. I'm not going to bother to buy this place. I'm only going to be here for a few years. I'm going to squat on it. So you have squatters all over the place. And then you have people that are living on the place that are not farming it. And all sorts of complications. So that when you drive through a landscape, you don't know who owns the place, whether the bank owns it, whether he owns it, whether his children own it, or whether it's part of something else. There is no way of reading the landscape as clearly as we would have in the old days. And you see, that little white house belongs to Farmer Jones, and look what a good farmer he is. Look how well tilled his fields are. Then you have an idea of the sanctity of place when it tells about the person who lives on it. You can't tell that anymore. You can't even tell it about a private house. But this turnover in our spaces, which has been a source of enormous vitality, economic and social and everything else in the United States, has produced a very different landscape. And as we move west of the Mississippi, we're making towns, and we're using the grid almost invariably to lay them out. And if you read the reports of travelers in the Midwest up until comparatively recently, they say what a raw landscape is, how unfinished it is, how people are moving all the time, and houses are abandoned, houses being put up overnight, houses are being moved with teams of oxen pulling them from place to place, and not quite understanding what's going on in the United States. It's just in constant motion. Though I think we as Americans look back, and our parents would have told us, it wasn't that way at all. It was a very peaceful life. But to Europeans, it seemed as if it was complete chaos. There's a very good book that was written about the cities of the American West by John Reps. I don't know whether you're familiar with him, but he's a great cartographer at Cornell. And he's published three books of maps of American cities, maps that were the original maps, no, the original plans, not what they are now, but what they were supposed to be when they were laid out, which, of course, is something quite different. Always this incessant grid. And he has a very good text with it, and it's a beautiful book because it's illustrated with the original colored lithographs of 1870 and 1880. These bird's eye views, you know, those Victorian bird's eye views, which are not actually maps, but give you that impression. Well, as you look at these maps, you see that this grid system is being used to move around in, that the first towns would have clustered around the village square, one square. There'd be the church and the courthouse and the jail and the post office. That would be the center. That's obviously the center of town. And then it begins to shift a little bit, and you find that the center of town is down by the railroad tracks and the city hall and the post office and everything a little farther away. So they get down to the railroad tracks, or else they're along the river. In other words, they're just shifting around in these spaces. It makes no difference where they are. The spaces are all the same. So the towns are becoming very fluid and very flexible. And this goes on, of course, and the way our towns are organized change throughout the centuries as new centers develop. Now, I fly very reluctantly, but I do. And as you look down, as you're coming near to the airport, you begin, or at least I begin, to look for the signs of the grid because I'm obsessed with it. I'm an American that's been imprinted on me, like everybody else, to find the grid. And you look down and you begin to see this grid outside of town. And the great squares, of course, a square mile is a sizable area. And there'd be one little development there of about 20 houses on a little curved road. And each of them has a little front lawn. And some of them have a bright blue swimming pool in the back. And they all lead out to a straight road which goes into town eventually. And you fly over these and you see the grid. There it is. But most of it is neglected because these little developments are more important than raising cows or crops of corn or anything else. And then you get nearer to town, and you see that there's a new center for it. As you fly down, you're getting nearer, and things go faster under you, of course, and the developments get thicker and thicker and thicker. And then you see the interstate going around there someplace across the horizon. And the interstate is now becoming the center of stuff. That's near where the airport very often is, and it's near where this great sea of warehouses is, which is one, to me, is one of the most astonishing views one gets in an American city now. If you go into a place like as large as Los Angeles, for instance, miles and miles of warehouses near the where the interstate has an interchange, and usually near the airport. And because the airport is also part of this new industrial setup, and where there, as you probably know, it always astonishes me how airport is becoming a new kind of community. There you have conference centers, you have movie houses, you have special restaurants, you have special repair facilities. Everything is settled out there, and you have people who go to conferences at the airport, and they will have come 2,000 miles in either direction just to meet at an airport to have a conference. So this is one of the things where the town is beginning to show this strange distortion and strange use of spaces as it moves around this way. And then as you get down and you're going faster and faster, you're almost, seems as if you're almost at rooftop, then you begin to come near the center of the city, the modern business with the big high-rise, glass high-rise buildings and enormous parking lots around it, and a shabby neighborhood of sort of semi-abandoned bungalows and houses with great trees in front of it, and more parking lots, and then you're in town. And that's what you see as you go into town. And what I see, of course, is what everybody else sees, that just as we're coming into town, and you get a big view of it, I'm thinking of not Memphis. I don't know Memphis well enough, but I've flown over a good many American cities, whether it happens to be Minneapolis or San Francisco or L.A. or Tucson or wherever. And as you come down in, then you get into you get over the city, and there's the grid, only it's a much smaller grid because they're blocks now, they're not square miles. And there are the nice little houses, one after the other, with the little backyards and the tree-lined streets, and it goes on and on and on and on. And then the big high-rise is way off in the distance where downtown is. And that's what you see. And when you get to the town, and I always want to see something in the town, and you ask people what you ought to see, or you pick up the thing in the motel or wherever it is to see what the sights are, and they say, well, of course, you ought to go see our new civic center. That's very impressive. And we have a new art museum. And then, of course, there's Old Town, where they have gas lights, and they have brick sidewalks. And then you must go out to the Country Club District, where some very fine houses are. And then you say, yes, you certainly do want to see all those things. But you also want to see, at least I want to see, the checkerboard of those tree-lined streets. And that's the grid. I've got to be in that grid to feel at home. And so I look for some way of finding out, and I get up a map of the city, and this is what I found here in Memphis. I don't know whether you're familiar with it, but it's free. You can find this in all the newsstands around here. You go to any supermarket, and it has pictures of all the houses for rent, for sale in Memphis. Look at that. This is an invaluable book. I've got about 20 of them, and nothing like as handsome as this. This seems to be something quite special. But they have them in every supermarket all over the United States. And if you collect these, as I do, you've got a very good image of what the American home is. And of the middle class and lower middle class, well, there's some expensive houses for sale in here, but it is astonishing what you can learn from one of these things about house types, about what makes a house attractive and saleable, and tells you also about the districts in the city. I really seriously recommend anybody who's interested in vernacular architecture acquiring these wherever city they go to. The little information they give about it, it's usually called Homes Magazine, and it's usually in much smaller than this. At least the cities where I go to, they're much, much more modest than this. But they illustrate, they tell the type of the house, and its location and its price, and they all of them describe themselves in a little caption underneath to tell what their merits are. And the offer's attraction, the presence of a fenced backyard or ceiling fans, or the fact that they're within walking distance of the high school, elementary school, a bus stop or a shopping center. And then they very often give the name of somebody you can call up and ask questions after 6 o'clock. Call Shirley. And then they give the number. it's a wonderful introduction to any town, Memphis. I'm going to use it to get to know people. But what one learns here from studying it is a certain uniformity in the houses. And there is a range of choices in these houses, in these books. Every real estate agent has a page in here. They're not all in the hands of one agent. And there are the houses that are near the country club, which have a circular drive, which, of course, is the last word in desirability. And then you go to houses and mobile homes in the remoter district where the roads aren't even paved. But sooner or later, you see the underlying similarity of these houses, and then the grid comes out. It comes out like something indelible that's right there. If you look at it hard enough, you see the grid system coming out, and you see that these houses and the grid have a great deal in common. And what impresses me, and I'm not condescending to these houses, because I think they're very nice and be very happy to live in almost any of them, is that they're very uniform. Underneath this variety of price and of location and of age, there is a similarity to the sort of generic American house, it seems to me. And then none of these houses here, anywhere else that advertise, are eccentric or ostentatious. If you want to see ostentatious houses of this sort, of residences, go to Italy. Go to Mexico, go to even parts of France. There you see real ostentation and real tastelessness. You don't find that in the United States. You don't. You find nothing that's very ostentatious or eccentric here. And neither does one find, I know they exist, but generally speaking, there's very few of these houses or anywhere that are so squalid and dilapidated that they can't be redeemed or gentrified. I think it'd be very hard. Of course, one does find houses that are totally impossible, but generally speaking, our houses conform to a national taste and a national standard, so that one could look at any of these and say, with a few thousand dollars, I can make this into an attractive house. They are capable of redemption, capable of gentrification. There is something parallel here to this notion that everybody is capable of redemption. Everybody's capable of going to heaven. But they are all very rational in design and in layout, and they're oriented more to the street than to their neighbors. We're very neighborly people, I think, but it is strange to find that there's no relationship, spatial relationship, very often between houses. They'll call to each other and they'll go into each other's yards, but there's no spatial design which involves everybody in a larger unit. It's only with the street that seems to be it. That's all right. That's the way houses apparently are, but I don't think that this is a universal tendency, that you don't pay any attention to your neighbor or don't have anything to do with it. And there's no pretension here to being a work of art. Now, I think that this is quite justified in not feeling your work of art. But again, to come back to the European experience, very often one does find small houses, they may be old houses, they may be grandiose houses, which are obviously designed to be works of art and succeed in it. I don't think one finds much of that. You will find, perhaps if you go to Newport and look at some of the so-called cottages there, there is an attempt to produce a real work of art. But generally speaking, I think the American, no matter how much money he has, or how large a family, is not designing his house as a work of art. He is designing it as a utility, as something which is extraordinarily satisfactory in many ways, but is not supposed to be a work of art. So you look in vain here for any kind of pretense. I'm offering these as virtues, but in the long run, they come down to a denial of something. These are anonymous houses, and they're without mystery. There is no mystery. There may be a dead body under the bed, but the whole effect of it is it has no mystery. It has no, what they call, no pathos to it at all. There's nothing that makes you think twice about that house or think about it at all. And you look, you find very few examples, either fake or genuine regional styles. Now, I'm sure you will all say that's not true. I can show you a southern plantation house on the next block. That's true. There is that element here. But generally speaking, in these houses here, you'll find one or two colonial, so-called Mount Vernon-type houses, one or two Williamsburg, but there is no regional style that one can discover, at least by the standard definitions of regionalism. I would say that you have a certain type of bungalow here, which is definitely regional. But generally speaking, these houses have no architectural pretension whatsoever to be regional or to be works of art or to be anything like that. And the whole effect of driving through, and today I had the good fortune of being driven around in some parts of Memphis, and charming tree-lined streets with comfortable, attractive houses with a certain monotony of the bungalow type, there's no doubt about it, which I don't object to at all, but there was this monotony. But it was a very reassuring thing to see how many comfortable, respectable, attractive-looking houses there were. And I think it would be inappropriate to criticize them in any architectural, certainly academic architectural terms. You accept them for what they are, as excellent places to live. But the more you ponder these houses, and the more they seem to be the logical reflection of the grid landscape and the grid definition of place, which is simply something which has a use at that particular moment. The simplicity and uniformity, interchangeability of the grid, its indifference to history and topography, are all more or less reflected in the type of the American house that we have. And if we were to rewrite the story of American architecture, the history of American architecture, I think we could leave out that familiar topic of the change from one style to another, from colonial to Gothic to Victorian, whatever it may be. Forget all that and rewrite the history as a process of stripping away of myth and symbolism. And you get down to the basic American house, which we've almost reached, I think. And I personally think we have reached it. And I say this not to irritate people, but I think the mobile home, the trailer, is the basic American house. And we have stripped off all of this symbolism, and we get down to the demythologized house, which is what we're all approaching. And every generation sees a few more myths and symbols stripped off of the house, and we're getting down to the demythologized house, which is small, convenient, cheerful, temporary, resting very lightly on its green rectangular space in a demythologized landscape. It never was and never will be a landmark. It never will be. It never will have that pathos. It resembles the trailer, if not in form, at least in spirit, ready to move away and disappear. Now, this picture of the American city, which I've made, is exactly what foreigners pick on. See, you're talking about American city, and look what a monotonous thing it is. It has no neighborhoods, it has no quality, has no architecture, has no art, has no monuments, it's nothing, it's just monotonous. And this is what we hear. And we hear it not only from foreigners, but we hear it from sensitive Americans. And this is where I really find myself irritated, that we should fall for this particular line of discussion. Because this verdict that the American city is monotonous, without character and everything, is that has no individuality and no variety and so forth, is essentially the judgment of the architect and urbanist. It's not even the artist involved here. It's the architect and urbanist who will point out the monotony or the dreariness or the lack of inspiration in some of our streets and some of our houses. We ourselves are not aware of that, but they are, and they impressed it on us, that that our houses are not works of art, and we are consequently, when we accept this point of view, we are accepting the point of view of, I consider, essentially an academic elite, which tells us that our cities are monotonous and have no sense of place and everything. It's quite true. I'm not denying the fact that we don't have monuments, that we don't have ruins, that we don't have works of art in, I'm sure this is true of most of Memphis. Why should I spare Memphis? That we don't have works of art in our residential sections. But I dare say it's a very old-fashioned idea, but I feel that in the public realm, which is what we're talking about, we're not talking about what's in your garden or what's in your house or what's in a museum. In the public realm, art commemorates events and people. In other words, it is subsequent to people and events. Then comes the art to jog our memory. That's what a monument is, of course, something which reminds us. So if our towns are new and changing all the time, there's not much at the moment to commemorate. That's one reason why we don't have it. But I think that this whole discussion of sense of place based on monuments, based on designed atmosphere, is this whole discussion of it is largely confined to a small, educated, environmentally sensitive, upper-middle-class minority in this country. And I don't think they're perfectly entitled to this opinion, and they can justify it, and they're quite right. We ought to have the monuments. But I don't think it behooves us to accept this as the final verdict on the American city. And when we talk about whether we have any character to our cities, and you point out the fact that our houses are all almost identical, the answer to that is that the character of the city does not depend on its forms and spaces, but depends on something else, which is the interaction of people and the interaction of us, of ourselves with time. You ask any American, no matter what his class, what his degree of education, or her degree of education, what is your town like, or is your town like every other city? They will not say that. If they're at all sincere, they will say, Omaha is totally unlike, you never saw such a place as Omaha. It's quite unlike any other place. And they will enumerate the things that make Omaha different. But the things that make Omaha different are not the monuments, and not the streets, and not the forms. It is usually a series of events or peculiarities of the town that we're all familiar with. If I were to ask any of you, I would get the same kind of response. I would say the town that I live in, for instance. Do you like it? Beside the point whether I like it or not, I would say where we have a fiesta. This is what brings a lot of people there, with fiesta. We have marvelous winter. We have winter sports there. We have a hideous spring, but we have a perfectly beautiful summer. In other words, we will talk in terms of time, in terms of moments, and this is what builds up finally to a sense of identity, is when we feel that we are participating in schedules and timetables and routines. This is, I think, is what makes a town, is our feeling that we are part of a process rather than part of a series of forms, or that we move among a certain forms. This is not new. My idea in this line is not new at all. That this goes back, I think, if you go back into any past, is the vernacular. In other words, the man on the street, which is, or the woman on the street, which is what we all are many hours of the day, whatever we happen to be at the moment. But the man on the street will identify his town with certain features of his workaday life, certain events in his workaday life. And we do not decide whether our city is unique by its forms and traces, but by the way they are used, by the sequence of daily, weekly, yearly events. And this has always been the case, it seems to me, certainly with the vernacular element of the population. The old world farm, the European farm village, came to life when it observed the traditional farm calendar and the church calendar, the special days with the special rites for plowing, for planting, for harvesting, the days for the honoring of the patron saint, the local festival. It was not the composition of open spaces and the surrounding structures which made the marketplace beautiful. It was the moment, the day, which made the marketplace beautiful. It's the very absence of monuments and architectural features in most American communities that fosters this emphasis on the reoccurrence of events as rallying points. I hope you understand that what I'm trying to say is that the grid system has eliminated our capacity to gather around sacred spaces, and at the same time has released us to look to the calendar and to something else for the centers of our existence. We have, of course, largely abandoned the traditional architectural calendar, based as it is on the cycle of seasons and recurring movements of heavenly bodies. But to take its place, we have evolved in town after town our own much richer cyclical calendar. Holidays, the opening and closing of school, the baseball or basketball or football season, elections, weekend excursions, the routine of commuting to and from work, the weekend shopping spree. The spaces in our contemporary urban environment that are most of the time without interest or artistic merit, and I'm thinking of parking places as much as anything else, the shopping center, the sports arena, the playground, the street, all come to life and serve as a setting for some brief popular event which gives rhythm and vitality to the city. So if you want monuments, and we do want monuments, these monuments should arise as part of the setting of some significant event or some recurring event. This is what monuments are. They remind us of this event. There's no use putting the monuments in there when they're not commemorating anything, which is what we're doing very often now. This is where I think the popular mind is right, that the event is more important than the setting. The setting comes as a result of the event. I am always amazed, and I'm sure I share this with others, when you find somebody who is so thoroughly at home with the routine of their city. And one finds this, I think, particularly among taxi drivers, who are so aware of where they're going to get their business and when they're going to get their business and where it's going to go and everything else. They're very sensitive to these things. When I was in Houston last week, I took a taxi to the airport, and the driver said, "I'm not taking you by the freeway. I'm taking you over Laurel Boulevard," and they were going on Farm to Market Road 52 and get to the airport that way. And I said, "Why?" He said, "Because Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, the highway is always jammed." Well, this is a wonderful response to the routine of a city. There's a man who knew his city. And this is what we all know in an extraordinary way if we brought it to the surface a little more. One of the things which amazes me, when you go to a city and you're sitting with somebody who knows the city well, how immediately they respond or anticipate the change of the light. Well, now, those lights all have different intervals, as you know, from one city to another. But somebody who lives in Memphis will start up and get into gear before the light is changed from red to green. This is something that I admire. This is part of this sense of time that we have, and that we should cultivate it, of course. But I think we should observe it in our city if we were in a position of studying our city. Now, the architects have done a wonderful job of cataloging all the architectural features of Memphis, shall we say. How about somebody getting out and finding these various rhythms that are going on day by day, season by season, area by area, for that matter, and seeing if we're not getting a kind of a symphony of rhythms here, which is typically Memphis rather than any other town. So it makes no difference whatsoever. If somebody comes in and says, "Memphis, you look just like Little Rock," or whatever it may be, you know that it isn't, and you have the proof of it. This is sociology of time, which is something which I think we ought to cultivate, or should be cultivated, because we're not all in a position to do it. But this is something relatively new, this notion that how people use time and the schedules they establish is a very interesting topic, and I say that because I've just been reading about it, and it was quite new to me. But there was a very interesting book called The 7-Day Cycle by somebody whose name I find very difficult to pronounce. He's a professor at Brandeis University in Boston, Eviatar Zerubbarelli. It's a Jewish name, and he is a Jew. And he has written, this 7-Day Cycle is a book about the week and what the week means in our urban society and how we have become so that we talk in terms of weeks and calculate in terms of week to an extraordinary extent, which they wouldn't have done 100 years ago and probably would not have done at all 300 years ago when they had different kind of way of telling time. But I think what he says about the week is an indication of why it's so very satisfactory. And if you think how many times we're using the word week, the college season is so many weeks long, the next term is so many weeks long, he's going to be in the hospital for so many weeks, this job is going to take me so many weeks, instead of days or months or anything else. It's always weeks that we're talking about. And he says, the week is the only major rhythmic component of our environment that is essentially artificial and totally oblivious to nature. I don't know whether the idea comes across here, but the week is not based on anything celestial at all. It is a purely man-made thing. Every other thing, the month and the day and the year, of course, are all based on heavenly bodies. But the week is something that we invented ourselves and which varies from country to country, at least from civilization to civilization. And one of the interesting chapters in the history of, in the sociology of time, is the attempt to suppress the week. It was suppressed in Soviet Russia completely. They deliberately wanted to do away with the religious aspect of it. In other words, Sunday was what they were after. But they saw to it that some people would start their job. They may have only worked for 7 days or 5 days, whatever it was, but somebody would start his job on Monday, somebody else would start theirs on Thursday, so that they would never get together on one day off. And this went on, and finally Stalin abolished it in the 30s. But the previous attempt to dispose of the week was done at the time of the French Revolution, when they decided that they'd have a week of 10 days, again, to get the church out of the picture, so that they had the week had a 10-day week. And at that time, of course, they were still practicing Catholics and wanted to get married on either Sunday or whatever their saint's day was, and had an awful time adjusting it to it. And it lasted for about 10 years of this awful 10-day week, with every day having a different name, of course. They had a whole different thing. Well, it was part of this system which Jefferson was, I won't say tarred with, but was obviously sympathetic with, of having the decimal system and everything, because they even had pocket watches which had 100 minutes on it. You could still buy them in Paris when I was a boy. You could buy watches which had 100 minutes on it. That was part of the whole system of 100 minutes and 10 days for the week. But to come back to the week, this is something that is so part of our system that we have adopted, I think deliberately, something which is artificial and not in nature to fit in with our grid system, which is artificial and not natural too. It's part of a system which works perfectly well, regardless of its not having any roots in the soil. Here we have a way of telling time and of living and of moving. Both of them artificial, the week and the grid system. So this is something I think that deserves more study, because there's nothing that divides people, as the Russian experiment proved, better than two different schedules. Two different ways of going to church, two different ways of eating, hours of eating. This divides people very sharply. By the same token, when you share these things, you're brought very close together. A lot of communities are based not on the space they occupy, but on the schedule that they share together. And that's something that I think we all are part of without our necessarily recognizing the fact that the element of time is what gives our communities, and the way we organize time is what gives our communities their sense of place, or shall we call it a sense of time, that makes it different from anything else. and we've got it. And so don't be discouraged by people saying that our towns are monotonous. To be sure they're monotonous. But we have within this monotony a wonderful individuality which deserves exploration. But I think that I come back to my favorite topics of landscape studies, because I do like to study, as you can see, the way our landscapes have been transformed. And I think that, generally speaking, environmental studies, shall I say, architecture, landscape architecture, planning, have been too much concerned with space and the organization of space, and have been too ignorant of time. They've not paid enough attention to time, its organization, and its importance, and what it means in the way of understanding processes and change and growth and whatever it is. This is part of studying the landscape as well as studying the forms that are in it. So let me finish by quoting from the theologian Paul Tillich. The power of space is great, he wrote in a book called Culture and Theology, and it is always active for both for creation and destruction. It is the basis of the desire of any group of human beings to have a place of their own, a place which gives them reality, presence, power of living, which feeds them body and soul. But every space is limited, and so the conflict arises between the limited space of any human group, even of mankind itself, and the unlimited claim which follows from the deification of this space. We are deifying space. Tragedy and injustice belong to the gods of space. Historical fulfillment and justice belong to the God who acts in time and through time, uniting the separated spaces of his universe in love. I have some more pictures. Perhaps I better show them to you. I was going to say that that was all I had to say, but I do have a few more slides. This is what you see as you're flying in. This was, I think it must have been Denver when they just had a snowstorm. There's your grid, you see, it's there. And that's what your eye is fascinated by. And there are the little subdivisions of identical houses, all stucco, one story, two-car garage, two bedrooms, two-and-a-half baths. Okay. Could we get the next one? And here it is closer, too. Well, it doesn't tell a different story, but it is the same thing. It's so rare that I take a picture that's any good that I have to show it. May I have the next one? And here is, I guess this was Denver. I guess that's Denver, but there you are. There are the buildings by Pei and Philip Johnson. They were all supposed to come and admire. And here are the big empty parking lots around where they've done some urban renewal. Look at the parking lot. And this is where the art museum is. Here is where they've got their new Victorian street with pavement. And this is where the art museum is over here. And the Chic Hotel is there. That's all you're just supposed to see. Okay. And here is what the street does. I think that's a wonderful picture. I didn't take it, needless to say. I think that's must be Fifth Avenue. It's extraordinary. Of course, it's distorted because Fifth Avenue would get narrow. But that's what the street means. All of this is just ornament, just decoration. This is the important thing, whether one likes it or not. This is the basis of the grid, is this marvelous street cutting through everything. Okay. This is part of what downtown trying to be interesting. This is in Denver. This is, I don't know what this is to be, combination convention center, little theater. Art museum, every damn thing was going to be under this thing. I don't know how successful it is. But this is an attempt to make downtown Denver interesting. Okay. And this is interesting. This is Philip Johnson. This is in Houston. This is an extraordinary building. I don't know how many of you have been to Houston, but it is an extraordinary place to see. Okay. This is my own drawing of what Harlem looks like from Columbus. Columbia University, looking out and seeing all the tenements in Harlem. Okay. This is it. This is it. Now, this is what we laugh at and find ridiculous. But this is what a lot of very attractive developments looked like 20 years ago or 30 years ago, as you all know, that Levittown was like this, and everybody was in horror. You show them a picture like that, I said, my God, what's happening to the United States? Levittown is now a very attractive tree-grown place with the houses painted different colors, and people have added to them, and people have done things. So this is the way we start out with uniformity, and then we develop something. There's no use trying to implant originality in the first go. Okay. This is a trailer court in altitude. What should I say about that? It's not as bad as it looks. I wouldn't mind living in one of those trailers. Okay. Now this is, I find this interesting as a comment on how, this is a picture that was drawn of an attempt to do something in Chicago back in, I don't know, 1899 or sometime like that by Burnham. And this was, he was just fascinated with these enormous boulevards. But look at the traffic on those streets. This is what the 19th century thought of. This is the street that they thought of this kind of stuff. So of course you had to have monuments all over the place. The vitality now is here. This is one enormous traffic jam on both sides. And this is what the 19th century saw the street as, just an enormous, beautiful space. So there is such a thing as an obsession with space. As this quotation says, there is an obsession with space, whereas what space is containing is what we should be interested in, and that is vitality. Well, that's all. Thank you for your attention.
Mr. Jackson did say that he would answer any questions, if there are any, for a few moments. Does anyone have a question?
I couldn't see any hands if they did have.
It's too dark to see.
Yeah, there's a hand. We can't see the hands, that's the reason. Did you put up your hand?
There's...
I'm thinking, of course, in terms of the built environment. Psychologically, I think you're quite right. But I'm thinking, perhaps in limited terms, of the great expanse of plain America, the plains America, where the natural environment does not play much of a role. I think a great many of us want to get back to it, but it's a tricky balance. We don't want to get too deep into it. I mean, we don't want to get too dependent on it. And, of course, we have not very well. Is a good thing, just like that killing thing. That time is really where we grow and develop and become somebody. It's not through space, it's through time. And I think that perhaps that is a little bit of a criterion rather than space. Yes?
What do you think about the green belt here?
The green belt?
Yes.
Well, have you one here?
No.
You haven't?
What?
Well, I know that they I don't know how popular it is in the United States. I know in England, of course, they have it. It's now being invaded very badly, as you know, in England. They simply cannot keep it. Roads are going through it, and then, of course, alongside the roads come factories and things like that, so that it hasn't been particularly successful. I don't know where. I know that in New Deal days, we did want to have it, and we had Greenbelt cities and Greenbelt towns. I'm not familiar with how it works anywhere else. That's right. Yes, in order to keep land from being developed, isn't that the idea? There's no leapfrogging of the city beyond that.
Right.
Well, thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.